Welcome to the Living God Church podcast, where faith comes alive. Join us for powerful messages that inspire, challenge, and equip you to grow closer to God and love Jesus more every day.
If you have your Bibles, go ahead and let's head to John chapter 2. If you guys were here for any part of our John series, like Pastor Brandon mentioned, we wrapped up chapter 1, and we took a break for the Easter season. And now we're back.
Hold on a second.
All right. So John chapter 2 is where we're going to be headed. But I want to give us a recap. Try to talk not so loud. I want to give us a recap of chapter 1 real quick so that we kind of set the stage for where we're headed in chapter 2. So John's gospel, the gospel according to John, was written by the apostle John, the disciple John the beloved. John, the one who both laid his head on Christ's chest at the Last Supper, but also made a quick little note that he outran Peter to the tomb, because that's how guys are competitive. And he was like, I'm going to put that in there. I beat Peter. This John the Beloved is the same guy who wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, his letters to the church, and the book of Revelations, all right? The revealing of Christ, that he wrote that book after his vision on the Isle of Patmos. The Gospel of John was likely written at the end of the first century, so somewhere around 90-ish AD, at the end of John's life when he lived in Ephesus as a bishop or an overseer of the church. This is evidence because John is, in church history, the only disciple to not be martyred. All of the other disciples at this point have been either crucified or flayed or ran through with a spear or swords or stoned. They tried to kill John, but God wasn't done with him, and so John remained on earth even though he had been boiled in hot oil or tar, and he'd been thrown off and beaten, thrown off a building and beaten and imprisoned. He's still alive. And so at the end of his life, he's entrusted with two very precious things to the Lord. Number one, his mother Mary, because we see on the cross in the Gospel of John, Jesus entrusts Mary to John. But also, he's in charge of helping oversee the church, right? He's the last living apostle to have walked physically with Christ at this point. And church history tells us that the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Mark, which is Peter's account, and the Gospel of Luke, which was eyewitness testimonies, all already existed. But by the end of the first century, there was some bad teaching. We call it heresy. There was some heretical teaching, specifically a thing called Gnosticism, which elevates spiritual experiential things over the Word of God. And that still exists today in the church. And so what happened was questions began to arise. Well, what made Jesus so special? Maybe he wasn't even God. Maybe he was a created being. Maybe we can all ascend to the same level as God. And so John is begged, according to church history, by leaders, and they say, please, will you write your account? You're the last living survivor who walked with Christ physically. Can you tell us your story? And so we know that Matthew starts with the genealogy, and Mark starts with the baptism, and Luke starts with the birth. But John said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He took us all the way back before Genesis and said, let me give you my account. And my account is here for one reason. It is to glorify Christ and to make his deity known so that there's no question. Jesus was God, he is God, and will forever be God. And that's what John set out to accomplish. We know that his letters and his gospel actually did help to push back Gnosticism. And, you know, the church was able to grow, specifically out of the heart of Ephesus, where he was an overseer. And so we went through chapter 1. We talked about the divinity of Christ. We talked about in our series John the Baptist, Jesus' cousin, who baptizes Jesus in the Jordan River. The Father proclaims and the dove descends in the Jordan River. And then John the Baptist points everyone to the Lamb who takes away the sins of the world. He even points his own disciples. Some of his disciples leave him and follow Christ. And isn't that what we're all called to do? We're all called to take people and say, hey, you need what I have. I don't have anything to give you, but I'll give you the one who gave me everything, which is Christ. And we point people to the Lamb who takes away the sins of the world. And then at the very end of chapter 1, we see the calling of Philip and Nathanael to be disciples. So at this point in John's gospel, he has around 6 disciples. John, James, Philip, Nathanael, Andrew, Peter. Those are mostly agreed upon as his disciples. He hasn't called Matthew yet. He hasn't called the others yet. But then we go into chapter 2, and we're going to dive through a story that is probably very familiar to all of you. It's probably one of the most notable miracles that's referenced even in like pop culture, right? But I want us to see maybe beneath the surface what's happening in a dialogue that sometimes gets brushed through really quickly. You can read these next couple verses in like 30 seconds and be like, okay, cool, there was a miracle, right? And just move right on. But we're going to take some time to go verse by verse, and we're going to see what's hidden, I believe, in this conversation that happens with Jesus at a wedding. So, John chapter 2, are you there? Verse 1. Verse by verse. Verse 1 and verse 2 says, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. Okay, so Jesus grew up in Nazareth. Real quick history, born in Bethlehem, escapes to Egypt, comes back to Nazareth. And he grows up in Nazareth. That's why it is said in the end of chapter 1, can anything good come from Nazareth, right? It was like a look down upon town. That's where Jesus is from. It's the lower region of Galilee, which is in North Israel, so North Israel. And Cana was about 9 miles north of Nazareth, okay? So not real far, especially nowadays where you can drive, but 9-mile walk is a little bit of a distance. That's about how far they went. But they all traveled together, Jesus and his disciples and his mother. They go to a wedding. Why? Because they're invited. Jesus is a guest at this wedding because somebody extends an invitation. We know later on in the Gospel of John, it actually explains to us that Nathanael is from Cana. And so maybe there's a family connection. People have often wondered or studied out and tried to prove whether Jesus had relation to the bride and groom, all those kinds of things. But here's the reality. In first century Judea, weddings were a big deal, like big, big deal. You didn't just invite your close-knit family. You didn't cap it at like 50 and worry about who was going to cater. You invited like the town. And obviously, if these guys are coming from 9 miles away, it was more than just Cana that was there. It was a huge gathering. And people would come from miles because weddings were a big deal. You were betrothed or engaged and technically married for a long time before you then moved in together and started a life. That's why it says that Joseph was betrothed to Mary. They were married, but they weren't living together yet. And so this process that happens is very beautiful, and it really kind of parallels our story as the church with Christ. But weddings are a big deal. Weddings were a big event. And at this point in his ministry, Jesus hasn't performed any notable miracles. In fact, the Bible doesn't list any miracles. John says this was the first. There are some false teachings out there that will tell you that Jesus performed miracles as a child. He turned clay into birds, and he healed a friend who, fell, and all of these things. Those are not credible stories. As far as we know, scripturally, Jesus is born. He appears at the temple at 12 when his parents kind of forget God, and they walk off without him, and they have to come back for him, right? And then fast forward to the next appearance of Christ, he's likely 30 years old being baptized by John the Baptist, okay? So no notable miracles at this point. That's important because that's going to set up what comes next. Okay, verse 3. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Now, let me explain another facet of Judean wedding customs. Our weddings are like maybe a 30-minute ceremony, and then we go eat and dance for like an hour or 2 hours tops because everybody's tired and dressed up, and then we just get out of there, right? That is not how Judean weddings go. In fact, their wedding custom was to take the full week. And so oftentimes a wedding would last about 7 days. Imagine how many disco songs you'd have to listen to for 7 days, right? They didn't just show up and an hour into dinner, they go, oh man, we're out of wine. 7 days of partying and celebrating, and Middle Eastern cultures still do this today. I work with several folks from India. Their weddings are not a 1 hour or 2 hour event. They're a multi-day, multi-week, families coming from everywhere, food as much as you can eat and more, celebration, right? It's awesome. Nothing like what we do in America. I don't know where we got our custom from, but ours is lame compared to the fact that they get to eat for like people don't go to work. They just chill for 7 days and eat, right? Like somebody bring that over to the Western culture. Okay, so sometime within this 7 days, they run out of wine, which is a big deal. Running out of wine or food had social and financial impacts. Your family would be ostracized if you threw a party and then didn't prepare enough for the guests. Actually, one commentary says, weddings were such a big deal that if the bride and groom didn't like the gift you gave them, they could take legal action against you. Imagine that. You're the third person to bring a toaster and you're getting dragged to court because you don't need three toasters or five blenders, but you don't give a good enough gift and it's considered disrespectful to the family and they can drag you to court. That's how serious weddings were. So running out of wine is a good way to get your family kicked out of the city and completely ruin your name, bring shame to your family. So again, I just want to set this up. It's a big deal that they're out of wine and they probably have a couple more days of partying. And Mary looks at Jesus and says, bad news. They're out of wine. Okay? Verse 4. And Jesus said to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come. A couple things I want to address real quick. Number one, when he says woman here, don't take that disrespectfully. It's easy in our English translations to read woman and think, oh my gosh, Jesus was kind of mean to his mom. That's not at all what was happening here. Actually, this address was very common in Hebrew culture, and it was not a term of disrespect. It was actually a term of endearance. He was saying, it's like we would say mom. He was saying woman, but not in a disrespectful way. Okay? Woman, what does this have to do? The Greek says here, what is that to me and you? Okay? They're out of wine. What is that to me and you? He begs this question. What is that to me and you? But then he says this, and this is very interesting. This is where I think we don't focus enough when we read this passage. He says, my hour has not yet come. Now, a lot of people will read this, and they'll take it to mean Jesus was saying, I'm not supposed to do miracles yet. Right? We read it as, my hour has not yet come means Jesus saying, what do you want me to do about it? I'm not supposed to be doing miracles yet. But that's not actually what this means when he says, my hour has not yet come. We know this because John, the writer who we're reading in chapter 2, gives us clarity about what the hour is and when the hour takes place. Okay? The hour has not yet come. So after the triumphal entry, we just celebrated this with Palm Sunday, right? After the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, we see in John chapter 12 that some men came asking for Jesus. So we're going to skip a little bit far ahead into the gospel real quick, just to help frame this reference, my hour has not yet come. John 12, 21. These then came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida of Galilee, and began to ask him, saying, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip came and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip came and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, saying, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Okay, wedding at Cana, chapter 2, my hour has not yet come. John chapter 12, triumphal entry, Some guys come looking for him. Seems pretty harmless. They just say, hey, we want to talk to Jesus. And Jesus says, now we're here. Now my hour has come. And he goes on to reveal a little bit more. So same chapter, 12, verse 27. He says, now my soul has become troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name. And then a voice out of heaven. I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. So the crowd of people stood by, heard it, and were saying that it had thundered. But others were saying an angel had spoken to him. Jesus answered and said, the voice has not come for my sake, but for your sakes. Now judgment is upon the world. Now the ruler of the world will be cast out. And I, if I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself. He was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he was to die. Remember, this is in reference, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. This is a reference back to Moses. Moses, there's snakes in the camp, and they're biting people, and it's poisonous, and there's judgment. And Moses crafts a bronze serpent, and he lifts it up, and he says, if you will look unto this serpent, you will be healed. And this is a picture of Christ who will be lifted up on the cross, and if we look unto him, we will be saved. The great preacher Charles Spurgeon, he wasn't saved yet. He was a young man, and he walked into a church, and he sat in the very back row, and he was like, what am I doing here? I don't even want to be here. What am I doing with my life? And the minister on stage wasn't even that good at ministering, but he just kept saying one thing over and over, look unto Jesus, and you'll be saved. And the more he said it, the more Charles Spurgeon's heart began to burn inside him. And then he started to weep, and he ran to the altars and gave his life to the Lord. Became one of the greatest preachers in history. Look unto Jesus, right? So Jesus is saying, my hour has come that the Father may be glorified. And then he says, but I'm troubled, because he knows what that hour means. It means that he's going to the cross, right? Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane the night he's betrayed is praying with such stress and strain that he begins to sweat drops of blood. He knew what was ahead of him. And he says, should I ask that this hour would be taken away, or that I shouldn't have to go through this? He said, but the Father will be glorified. And then he begins to tell them, if I'm lifted up, I'll draw men to me, and that is the way he will die. What is his hour? His hour is what will lead him to the ultimate salvation. Because in the moment that he's revealed, we now have judgment upon the earth. Because now either you accept Christ or you reject him, but there's no middle ground. There's no, I'm going to toe the line and see if this thing pays off or not. There is only, the hour has come, Jesus is crucified, the Father's glorified, and in him he reconciles us to himself, and we have a crossroads before us. Do we look upon Jesus and are saved, or do we reject him and walk away from him? Either way, I love that he says, now that judgment's upon the world, the ruler of this world will be cast out. Either way, the enemy got defeated, right? The enemy is done. Jesus said it on the cross, tetelestai in Greek. It is finished. The enemy is disarmed. However, are you going to accept Christ or are you not? So what is he saying here when he says to his mother, my hour has not yet come? Not, I'm not supposed to do miracles yet. What he was saying is the time for my revealing in my moments to head towards the cross is not yet here. Right? So there's a bit of a controversy here, because some people will preach Jesus was trying to get Mary to lean in. He was giving her an opportunity. Basically, he was saying, no, now what are you going to do? But Jesus wasn't baiting his mom into trying to pull a miracle out of him, right? He wasn't trying to trick her and say, I'm not going to do it. All right, I'll do it because you ask really nicely. Right? That's not what's going on here. And some people will teach that Jesus is conflicted. He doesn't want to do the miracle because his hour hasn't come, but yet Mary is his mom and he has to respect his mom, so he does the miracle out of obligation. Again, that's not what's going on here, as best I can see it and study it out. What's going on here is Jesus says, the time for my revealing unto the cross has not yet come. So for me to be involved in this, it's going to have to be a little low key, right? It wasn't an invitation for her to try to convince him. And that's sometimes how we approach prayer. God, I need something from you. And if I pray long enough and I pray hard enough and I say the right things and I do the right dance and all of this stuff, maybe I can convince the Lord to answer my prayers. Maybe he doesn't have it figured out, so I'll give him some help. Lord, this is how I need you to solve my problems. And if you'll just do it my way, you'll see I know what I'm talking about. And the Lord, thankfully, in his mercy, doesn't cast us out, but like a good father picks us up and says, I've already accomplished it. I've already made provision. I've already taken care of it. Just come and rest in my presence. And sometimes we get so worked up in trying to convince God when ultimately he's got the plan so much better than what we could ask for. So much, it's so much of a better scenario for us, but also it brings him more glory than for me to say, I solved the problem and you know I told God how to do it and he did it my way, right? Boy, you talk about some pride that gets lifted up. So it's not about convincing Jesus that he needs to do a miracle. He was saying that it wasn't his time to be fully revealed to the world, which would happen as he was led to the cross. Now, this is further evidenced by a couple different passages. As Jesus goes on to perform subsequent miracles, he often says, until you get to the triumphal entry, he often says things like, hey, don't tell anybody. He bids them not to say anything or don't make a scene. Okay, some examples of this. When Jairus' daughter is brought back to life in Mark 5, Jesus clears the room out. Everybody's there. They're like, why are you even here? She's dead. The mourners are in there playing their flutes. And Jesus is like, all right, I need all of you guys out of the room except mom and dad. And he raises the little girl from the dead. And in Mark 5, he turns to them as they're celebrating and says, hey, let's keep this between us. Let's not make this a big deal. The leper that he cleanses in Matthew 8, he says, hey, go show yourself to the priest, but don't tell anybody. Right? Matthew 9, he heals the blind men, and then he says, don't tell anybody. He bids them not to say anything. Now, if you're trying to build this mega ministry with this awesome following and you want a big crowd, the last thing you want to do is tell people to keep it a secret. Right? Like, we want to do one little thing cool, and then we want to put it on Facebook and YouTube and Instagram and TikTok and all the things and get all the people to see it because, well, you need to follow me. Jesus is going around literally raising the dead, and what he's saying is, guys, keep this between us. Let's keep this secret. Why? Not because Jesus was ashamed, because Jesus knew his time to be revealed to the world had not come yet. So Jesus goes about doing miracles and preaching in small gatherings, and then eventually crowds start to follow him, partly because that was bound to happen, partly because every time he told somebody not to tell, what did they immediately do? They went and told the whole town. You got to come see this man, Jesus, right? The woman at the well, Jesus prophesies about her and her multiple husbands. And then she goes and runs back into town and says, you have to come see a man who told me everything I've ever done. And the whole town comes out to see Jesus, right? So eventually there was no keeping it a secret. But Jesus, as he's performing these miracles, subsequently after Cana, is telling people, the Lord is being glorified. It's awesome that you got your healing, but let's keep this a secret because my time, my hour has not yet come to be revealed. Okay? All right, verse 5. So his mother says to the servants, whatever he says to do, do it. Wait a minute. She says, Jesus, they're out of wine. He says, what is that to us? My hour has not yet come. She doesn't even respond to him. She looks at the servants and says, do whatever he tells you to do. Like, did you miss the part? Well, what does this tell us? It tells us that clearly Mary didn't receive Jesus' response as a rebuke. He wasn't saying, hey, leave me out of this. Can we go back and sit down? If he had said that, then Mary would have been in disobedience to the Son of God. right? He's her son, but he's also her creator. So for her to then instruct the servants to do whatever he says, it tells us that she didn't receive that as a rebuke, but she said, okay, I know that he's going to take care of it. Now, there's a second kind of controversy here, and that's that Jesus changed his mind. Some people will teach that. Jesus changed his mind. He came in there and said, I am not going to do any miracles today. And then she says, hey, do whatever he says. And he's like, oh, no. Well, I guess she kind of forced my hand. Maybe I should do the miracle. All right, I'll do it. That is not how the mind of God operates. Jesus is fully man, but also he's fully God at the same time. That means he's all-knowing. It means he's omniscient. He limits himself in that he is in a physical body that can only be in one place at one time, but he's still all-knowing in that he's God. And as God, he knows the end from the beginning. So for him to go, I don't know what's about to happen. Okay, I guess I should do a miracle, is actually counter to the nature of God, who holds the universe in motion, who knows the hairs on your head or the lack of hairs on some of our heads. Like, he knows every part of us, and yet Jesus is showing up to the wedding going, I don't know if I should do this miracle or not. That's not God. That's not the nature of God. God did not change his mind because he was baited into a miracle. Now, nothing against people that teach this, but I just think that it doesn't really give service to who God is. It teaches us, if we go down that train of thought, it teaches us that God is fickle. And then he's up there going, I hope it works out. I hope things go the way I want them to. And not this God who is sovereign over all, who's in control, and who knows what the outcome is, right? We serve a God who works all things according to the counsel of his own will. He doesn't need our advice. He doesn't need our prodding and our convincing. He already knows what he's going to do. So Jesus standing there, she says to the servants, do whatever he says to do. Mary believed that Jesus was special because she'd received a promise. But up to this point, again, we have no biblical reason to believe Jesus had ever performed a miracle in front of Mary. We have no proof in the text that Mary had ever seen him do a miracle. She believed in him for who he was, not what he had done. Do we have the same faith to believe in Christ when what we're praying for seemingly doesn't happen? Is our faith in only what he can do for us and not who he is to us? Miracles are awesome. But there's a lot of people who receive a miracle and still go to hell. There's a lot of people who can get a healing and still reject the Son of God and live an eternity away from him. The reality is the Bible never teaches us you have to believe in the miracle to be saved. It says believe in the miracle worker. Believe in Jesus. He's the way, the truth, and the life. None come to the Father except by him. Mary had belief because she'd been told who he was. And she believed who he was without any tricks, without any miracles, without any signs, without any teaching. She said, I know who he is, and I know he can solve any problem. So you guys, whatever he tells you to do, it's going to be the right thing. She believed in him for who he was. So verse 6, now there were 6 stone water pots that were set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. These stone pots were used for purification because stone was considered to have fewer impurities than, say, clay, right? So they would use these stone jars. And what they were used for is they were used for hand washing and feet washing. So what would happen in Jewish culture is you would come in and you would wash your hands and you'd sit down to eat. And then after you were done eating, you would stand up and wash your hands. Now, how many times are they eating across 7 days, right? They're eating a lot. That's why these stone water pots weren't like a little jar. They were huge because you got a whole wedding full of people and they're having to wash their hands before and after every meal, every single one of them. Now, this isn't like their hands are caked in mud and we got to get all the mud off. This is more ceremonial purification to the Jews. But the importance is everybody had to do it because you weren't allowed to touch the food if you were unclean, right? And so you have 7 days of having to to take water and to clean these guests' hands and feet before and after the meal. So the jars would have contained together somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons of water. That's a lot. Imagine how much water it takes. It takes a lot, right? So up to 180 gallons of water. The thing is, if we look for Christ in the Old Testament, it points to him. If we see Christ in the New Testament, he will point back to how the Old Testament was the law fulfilled in him. And what's interesting even about this situation is you have these pots that are filled with water, water that was supposed to purify them on the outside, right? Water meant to wash the dirt off their hands so they could be called clean. But all it was doing was touching the outside. This is a picture of what the law does, the Mosaic law. God hands his people the law in the Old Testament and says, take this and follow it and you'll remain clean before me. And when you inevitably mess it up, sacrifice is required. But the law is nothing more than ceremonial cleansing of an outward work. It still leaves the inside very messy. That's what these water pots represented. It represented ceremonial cleansing of the law on the outside. So verse 7, Jesus says to them, fill the water pots with water. So they filled them up to the brim. Why to the brim? I mean, like, isn't that dangerous? You could spill it. Why would you fill it all the way up to the brim? Jesus wanted no doubt that there was no deception. He wasn't adding anything to the water. Jesus wasn't going there with red food coloring and dipping it in there to try to convince people. Filling it up to the brim meant there was nothing that could be added to the water. So something miraculous had to take place inside the water. All right, verse 8 and 9. He said to them, this is Jesus, draw some out now and take it to the head waiter. So they took it to him, and when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom. A head waiter here, or the master of ceremony, as he's sometimes referred to, this was an honorary position that the family gave somebody, and it was their job to make sure that nobody ran out of food and wine. So already this guy's in the hot seat, right? Because he's like, oh man, we ran out of wine. How long can we go without the people noticing, right? And this is an honorary position the family's given him. So he's in a tough position. What's interesting to me is the way this is worded. Jesus says, draw out and take it to the head waiter. And it says, when the head waiter tasted the water which had become wine. This doesn't seem to indicate that the water became wine and then the servants drew out the wine and took it. It seems to indicate that Jesus had them fill up the pots with water and said, draw out the water. And they drew out the water. It's real easy for us to skip over this part, but imagine you're the servant who's walking up in front of a crowd of people to the head waiter and going, try this wine? They know it's water. It even says the head waiter didn't know where it came from, but the servants knew. They knew it was water. And they hand it to him, and they could very well go, this is about to look awful for us. We're servants. And we're handing the head of ceremonies water and calling it wine. And when he inevitably drinks this water and goes, what are you guys doing? Guess who's going to get in trouble? We're going to have to go try to find that guy who told us to fill it up with water because we're all going down for this. Like, this is crazy. We're handing this guy water and hoping that this guy who told us to fill it up with water isn't some lunatic. And yet, here we go. He's handed water. He drinks it and he goes, hey, wait a minute. Bring the groom over here. It's amazing the obedience these servants had. And maybe it was forced, but still. They didn't run for the hills. They carried the water to the servant, to the head waiter. How many times does the Lord ask us to do something and we're like, no, Lord, that sounds crazy. I'm good. I think I'm going to pass on this one. I don't want to look foolish, Lord. Those servants could have absolutely looked foolish. They filled the jars with water, not knowing what would happen next. They didn't perform the miracle, but they were invited to participate in it. This is something we're quick to tell our kids all the time. The Lord tells us in the scriptures to pray for the sick, to cast out devils, to go about and lay hands on people and preach the gospel. But the reality is, I don't save anybody. I don't heal anybody. I don't deliver anybody. It's never me. It's never any of you. I'm sorry if you thought that would build a cool ministry. It's not. Jesus alone saves and heals and delivers. But often he invites us just to be a participant. And the more that you serve the Lord and you see him transform lives, the more you realize, man, I didn't do anything. I got invited to be in the room while Jesus transformed a life. Yeah, he might have used a message that you spoke. He might have used a prayer that you prayed. He might have used your hand on somebody's back in agreement. He might have used a phone call when you called somebody because the Lord laid him on your heart. But make no mistake, it's the Lord who does the work. But he invites us to be a part of it. Jesus could have said, hold on, guys, I'm going to fill up the water pots, and I'm going to take the water, and I'm going to give it to the head waiter, and then when he tastes it, that it's wine, I get to tell him, hey, I did that, and everybody will celebrate me. Jesus didn't do that. He said, you guys fill up the water. You take the water to him. He invites them to participate in the miracle. And so what we see here is water that's used to purify on the outside through Christ becomes wine that is meant to purify the inside and bring us to life. Oftentimes, wine in the first century was used as a medicinal aid. Paul tells Timothy, hey, like, you have some stomach trouble, drink a little wine, right? It brings healing to the inside. But also the wine is oftentimes representative of the Spirit. And so through Christ, what cleansed us only on the outside becomes Spirit that now washes us on the inside and brings a sanctification that moves us from death to life and conforms us into the image of Christ so that we look like him. But also so that what used to fail us by only cleansing the outside is transformed by Christ to purify us on the inside. That is the picture of water into wine. It's not a party favor. It's not something cool that Jesus did to get credit, because he takes no credit for it. You read this, Jesus never once goes in front of the wedding party and goes, do y'all like that? Look what I did. In fact, he says, my hour's not yet come. I'm going to have some servants dole out some water to the waiter, but we're going to keep this a secret. Jesus transforms something that is only cleansing on the outside and makes it come alive on the inside. And that's what he did. He took the law that God handed us that we could never live up to. It was merely a mirror that shows us how dirty we are. And through Christ and his fulfillment, he gives us his life, and the Spirit comes and lives on the inside of us and makes us new. That is water into wine. So wrapping this up, verse 10, the head waiter says to the groom, he says, every man serves the good wine first when the people have drunk freely, and then he serves the poor wine. You kept the good wine till now. He's obviously puzzled. Now, in that culture, diluting the wine over a multi-day feast with water was very common. You get people there, you set the tone for the party. This is going to be awesome. Guys, drink as much as you want. This is amazing. And as the days progress, you start diluting the wine with water because you don't want to run out. And therefore, the cheaper wine, the poorer wine, it tends to be served last. This could imply that people were drinking so freely that they stopped caring that it tasted bad. However, in Jewish culture, drunkenness was looked down on. They weren't the Greeks, right? Jews looked down on the Greeks because they thought they were always wild and partying in excess. Jews liked to party, but they also knew that if you caused a scene because you'd been drunk, you and your family would be looked down on. So either way, the head waiter's like, this wine isn't diluted at all. This is the real stuff. This is good. John tells us this was the beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there a few days. John has just told us in chapter 1, verse 14, the word became flesh, dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. And now he tells us in chapter 2 that through this sign that happened at this wedding, that his glory is manifest, and now his disciples believed. Notice this miracle wasn't for the masses. It was not for the entire wedding party. It wasn't for all the guests. And we don't have anywhere in the scriptures where Jesus even walks up to the head waiter and says, hey, I did that. Nowhere. Nowhere in chapter 2 does Jesus ever take credit for turning water into wine. But what happened is those tight-knit group of men who have said, I don't know who this guy is, but I'm going to follow him because when he talks, something on the inside of me comes alive, and I'm willing to leave my fishing practice. I'm willing to leave my family. I'm willing to leave John the Baptist, whatever it looks like. I'm willing to lay that down and follow this guy who, when he talks, there's something different about him. Now he performs a miracle, and they believe. They believe this really is the Messiah. This guy is who he says he is. What was the point of Jesus performing miraculous signs? It was to reveal that he was the Messiah. John tells us this in chapter 20, verse 30. John tells us at the end of his gospel, towards the end, he says, therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not even written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Why did John take the time to write down this miracle at the wedding of Cana? Because it's a sign that points that he is the Messiah. John records 7 miracles, and in those, they all point to him being the Messiah, which would lead into his hour where he's revealed and lifted up on a tree for the whole world to make that momentary judgment decision of, am I going to look unto Christ or am I going to reject him? John also says if we wrote down everything he did, all the books in the world couldn't contain it. I love that. You read the Gospels and you're like, man, there's some cool stuff in here. And John's like, yeah, we couldn't even write it all down. There's not enough books in the world to write down everything we saw and everything he did. Despite the miracles, though, some still did not believe. You have the Pharisees later demanding for a sign so they can validate him. On the flip side of that, though, we get to know his heart, and he validates us. And then he still gives us signs along the way. Our belief in him is for who he is, and then he shows us who he is by what he does. It's so beautiful. Our pastor used to say, if Jesus never does another thing for you, you have the cross, the ultimate sign of God's love. Romans 5:8, one of my favorite verses. God demonstrated his love toward us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. That is the sign of God's love for you and me. The cross is God's sign. For Jesus to provide wine for the Cana wedding feast, it took filling some jars with water. But for Jesus to provide the wine for his own wedding to the church, it took the cross. That's how much he loves us. The water into wine is a picture of outward cleansing and inward renewal, bringing brought to life. And then Jesus said, now my hour is revealed. And he's betrayed and led to the cross. This morning in team prayer, there's this song called The Blood, The Wonderful Blood, something like that. In the bridge, it says, the cross was your decision. Jesus wasn't trying to make up his mind what he was there for or what he was going to do. From the moment he was born, even before that, but the moment he was wrapped in flesh to the moment he marched to the cross, he was in control. And it was his decision. Why? Because God loved us so much that while we were lost and dead in our sin, and the only thing we could do is have our outside purified, he came to die on the cross to take our sins so that we could be made alive on the inside. How beautiful is that? The cross was his decision. He loved us that much. And even something like transforming water into wine at a wedding is a picture of Christ's love for us and what he would give on the cross for each and every one of us. Stand with me this morning. I hope that maybe next time you're in the Gospel of John and you read chapter 2, verse 1 through 12, that you take a moment to not just read through it real quick like it's a story, But take some time with the verses and what we've talked about today and picture it. Imagine it. Think about what it was. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a fable. This really happened. A man from Galilee really came and transformed water into wine at a wedding and didn't take any credit for it, but showed his followers who he was. That really happened. Take some time to sit with these verses and say, Jesus, you revealed yourself to your disciples. Reveal yourself to me because I want to know you even more. How beautiful. We got to be careful not to reduce the scriptures just to cool stories. They are life-transforming, living words breathed by God himself. And they'll change your life. They will. Can I pray for you real quick? Lord, we thank you for this time. Lord, this time in your presence, for your words that have spoken to our hearts, Lord, I pray that they would go deep and that we would see you. We would come to know you. Our belief would be in who you are, not just what you do, but who you are, and then show us who you are by what you do. Lord, move in each and every one of our lives. Lord, draw us near to you and reveal yourself to us so that we may walk in deeper fellowship and relationship with you. You're so gracious, and you came with intentionality, and you chose the cross, and you paid it all. You paid my debt that I could not repay. You took my place, and not only did you take my sin, but then you gave me your righteousness. And God, forever, you are worthy of worship. We love you and we thank you, God. Move us closer to you every day this week. In Jesus' holy name. Amen.
Thanks for joining us at Living God Church. We pray this word encouraged and challenged you. Be sure to stay connected and keep pursuing a deeper relationship with Jesus. Until next time, be blessed.